The Sunstone Foundation presents Drinking Deep of the Perian Spring, Personal Reactions to the Conflicts of Faith and Study, recorded live at the 1985 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 21st through the 24th. We take you to the Westin Hotel, Utah, in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Randy Heppner, and contrary to the printed material in your program, I'm a graduate student at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley and a seminarian at Pacific School of Religion rather than the San Francisco Theological Seminary. On behalf of the Society for the Study of Mormon Theology, I would like to welcome you to this hour's session, Drinking Deep of the Pierian Spring, Personal Reactions to the Conflicts of Faith and Study. By way of introduction, let me just say that the Society for the Study of Mormon Theology was founded in 1983 by serious students of Latter-day Saint theology and doctrinal history who desire to participate in the task of theological scholarship. Committed to the idea that theological clarification and formulation is necessary for both the preservation and integrity of religious faith, the Society is attempting to network a growing community of LDS, RLDS, and non-LDS students and scholars who are interested in serious theological reflection. At the same time, we hope to provide support structures for grassroots-level study groups. While the Society recognizes its deep-rooted tradition or its deep-rootedness in the progressive theological tradition ever present within Mormonism, the Society encourages critical thinking in all aspects of faith and doctrine, inviting and sustaining a rich commitment to pluralism and freedom of thought. At the same time, we recognize the fundamental importance of our common human religious experience and the multiplicity of ways in which God's will has manifested itself to various people throughout time. And for this reason, dialogue with the ideas and concerns of other religious traditions is of quintessential concern for both the Society and its work. And while much of the work of the Society is descriptive and academic in nature, this will not preclude the use of the prescriptive and prophetic voice. Indeed, the Society is committed to both theological formulation as well as clarification. In suggesting theological goals and values, the Society is aware of entering a controversial sphere. Although we refuse dogmatic formulas and closed theories, we are committed to the value of rational theological discourse. Consequently, a major task of the Society is the attempt to convince other persons that the search for orienting theories and the creation of religious values is complex but worthwhile. Several years ago, in a paper delivered as part of the Great Issues Forum at the University of Utah, Professor Sterling McMurrin noted, "It is often supposed that the chief threat to religion and religious culture is simply the body of knowledge accumulated by the natural sciences, that scientific knowledge contradicts the knowledge claims of religion or of religious culture. Accordingly, there is an opinion prevailing among us that the major academic hazard to a person's religious faith is the study of the natural sciences, and that, therefore, to run this course unscathed merits high moral approbation for the victor." After challenging this popular assumption, Professor McMurrin goes on to conclude, "It is the study of human beings, their ideas, and their behavior that really brings us face to face with the crucial problems of religion. And therefore, it is the humanistic disciplines, rather than the natural sciences, that are religion's chief intellectual challenge. But more than that, and this is the crux of the matter, it is the study of religion itself that occasions the most difficult and discomposing questions. It is when religion is studied and discussed seriously by rational and informed persons with open minds and honest intentions that it encounters its most severe testing. While it's quite certain that the conflict between religion and, or reason and faith is not new either to religion in general or Mormonism in particular, one could argue that an avalanche of new documents, historical conundrums, and philosophical and methodological complexities have added new dimensions to the conflict for the Mormon intellectual. Like many present here today, I too have experienced the deep and personal conflict that emerges in a serious and sustained treatment of one's religious faith. It was after several years of study as a religious studies and philosophy major as an undergraduate that my own rather dogmatic but fairly secure and most of all cherished Mormonism collapsed rapidly under the scrutiny of critical scholarship. It very soon appeared to me that very little of what I had been taught, either about my Mormonism or the larger Judeo-Christian tradition, had the sort of historical and philosophical foundations I had been led to assume. This, however, for me at least, has not led to an exodus out of the church. nor an abdication of what I consider my obligation and responsibility to my religious community. On the contrary, my commitment to work for religious change within the church of both a structural and theological nature grows continually, as does my conviction that we as Mormon intellectuals are not destined to forever play the part of the self-contained and self-justified Sunstonian gadflies. Rather, we as intellectuals must learn to assist our religious community in the arduous and difficult, but hopefully, and I believe, rewarding task of reform and renewal. Such is at least the partial intention and purpose of this panel discussion today. By way of introduction to our speakers, I will be incredibly succinct and simply draw your attention to the printed material in your program. Our three panel participants this morning are Chad Francisco, Eugene England, and Anthony Hutchinson. I guess one might say, I'm at the GTU, Eugene's at BYU, Tony's at the Catholic U, and Chad Francisco's at the Golden West Club listening to country western music. As you'll notice in your program, he's a self-styled, born-again country western fan. Seriously, though, Brother England needs no introduction within this audience. And I believe Tony Hutchinson won't need an introduction in this audience or throughout the church within 5 years from now. Chad definitely needs an introduction, but you're all going to know him just a few minutes from now. Chad.
I know my studies are not your studies. And I know that my reactions to the conflicts of study and faith are not your reactions. But in many cases they could be, and because they are to me so moving and so troubling, I feel the need to talk about them. There was a boy who believed in God. And when he was 7 years old, as boys do, he would get out of the earshot of his mother and he'd play catch with his best friend. And as he'd throw the ball to his best friend, he'd also shout out the worst, or maybe I should say the best obscenity his curious little mind could create. And if his buddy didn't catch the ball, his buddy caught the obscenity. But because of loving primary teacher and because of a mother and a father who nurtured this boy, when he was 8, he came up out of the waters of baptism clean, having experienced that profound sweetness that sometimes possesses the innocent. And so the story continues through the primary years, on into Aaronic priesthood, fellowship, and instruction. Instead of games for Christmas presents, there were mostly books and more books. There was a homemade sign, the words by Joseph Fielding Smith, the lettering by the hand of a 14-year-old, that he pasted on the stairwell wall, remembered to this day. We are not here to play, to dream, to drift. We have work to do and loads to lift. But don't get me wrong, they were not unhappy years. They were the most enjoyable of times, with school, baseball, family, and friends all given meaning by the perfect plan of a loving Father in heaven. Life was sweet and deepened with searching at times, hungering and thirsting after righteousness, prayers to receive a witness, seminary classes and Sabbath worship, teachers who truly inspired, all things working together in faith. And then one Sunday evening during a priest cottage meeting, so simple, the boy receives an answer. A perfect communication. The church is true. Your calling is to work with the youth of the church. So powerful. So totally possessing, so unearthly, so divine. Nothing could touch this feeling. Least of all, a few years later, some BYU geology professor tried to show a freshman that there had been life and death on Earth for more than 6,000 years. Joseph was a prophet, and he had revealed the Earth's history from the beginning of life and death to its final predetermined eschatological glory. And that and anything that didn't conform to scriptural truth was a deception to be someday revealed. The missionary preparation classes at the Y were the best. The kingdom would roll forth as the elect were gathered in. there was fasting and prayer on the side of the mountains of Utah Valley for spiritual reconfirmation and meditation on some unresolved questions by science professors. And even though there never was another spiritual experience like the first one, nor questions resolved with unquestioning assurance, there was a remembrance of a witness once received. The mission years were the best and the toughest. I witnessed Catholic worship as I had never imagined. I wondered how a Protestant could bear his testimony to me. But within the Mormon ranks, moments of camaraderie and love, witnessing lives change, sharing truth and commitment and study and prayer. And even though there never was another spiritual experience like the first, nor questions resolved, there was a remembrance of a witness once received. And there was a chance to ask a general authority face to face in the mission home my most perplexing question: why, even though I had labored unto sickness and through sickness and prayed unto many mornings, did I not experience the promise of knowing, of feeling again? Came the answer quick and strong: repent, elder, and be humble. And though there were tears of hurt, there were also moments of solemn reflection and a remembrance of a witness once received. From the mission field to the marriage altar to the realities of earning a living, I was in and out of night college courses, always with the goal of fulfilling the call to work with the youth of the church. Within a class or two of graduation to get a degree in Spanish — any degree will get you into the church education system — I changed my major to religious studies, which needs some explanation. CSULB, California State University at Long Beach, had a decent religious studies program. One of the most intriguing courses offered was on the Dead Sea Scrolls. I could not resist. I also took CES teacher training classes, and through the years, as many of the religious studies courses offered at CSULB as I could. The D&C injunction to learn all things for the glory of the kingdom was my intent. I studied the scrolls. I took a couple courses in OT, a couple more in New T, a couple more in the quest for the historical Jesus, a couple more in intertestamental history and literature, archaeology, anthropology, a year of Jewish history, class in Islamic culture, class in early church fathers and church history, Eastern religions, comparative religious thought, Arabic at UCLA, Hebrew at the University of Judaism, etc. Early on, I approached these studies with the conviction that even though my teachers were non-Mormons, I would discover truth, and truth would meld into one with the gospel. I dived into a study of the Dead Sea Scrolls, having listened to and read Mormon authors who convincingly bore their testimonies of the positive connections between Mormonism and ancient revealed practices. After less than a semester, I was shocked. I had read no less than 10 books on the Dead Sea Covenanters. I had read the finest translation of the Qumran sacred literature. I confess that I was angry at the collection of half-truths and distorted interpretations I had believed from ill-trained and narrow-minded Mormon experts on the scrolls. I tried Old Testament studies and found myself immersed in a battle to preserve beliefs and doctrines I considered sacred, revealed, central to the gospel. Many hours of institute classes and private conversations with teachers, dozens more reading Nibley, Sperry, Skousen, led me to no cohesive structure of belief supported by the unrelenting accumulation of facts those Gentiles threw at me daily. I even turned for help to people like Josh McDowell, a born-again Christian apologist. Archaeology and anthropology classes destroyed any lingering beliefs in biblical chronology or even Joseph's revealed confirmation of that chronology. Dispensationalism was nowhere to be found in any of the evidence I studied. However, evidence for the progressive evolution of man, both physically, intellectually, and spiritually, was everywhere. I remembered with shame how, as a teenager, I had thought my Uncle John Sorensen, a BYU professor of anthropology, was almost an apostate because he didn't believe in a worldwide Noachic flood. Now, after little more than a year of religious studies, I questioned everything, or so it seemed. I must repeat that when I started my religious studies, I balked at the whole system of historical, cultural, rational analysis. While other students were peering through newly opened windows, I was desperately seeking ways to slam them shut. This can't be. This is a trick of Satan to try the faith of the truth seeker. But my professors were not duped. History, archaeology, ancient literature, and scriptural themes were not tools of Satan. I could not ignore the years of training, the accumulated knowledge, the often brilliant analyses of my secular professors. And so I often retreated to the refuge of a witness once received. I confessed my frustration to the regional church education system teacher trainer. I also confessed my belief that the professors I was studying under were undeniably dedicated to the search for truth as much as I. He wanted to hear my whole story. A year and a half of having cherished beliefs challenged and often destroyed, after a single discussion with me, he had the answer. Give up studying with non-Mormons. Give up thinking that a Gentile scholar could possibly teach the whole truth. Give up studying various translations of the Bible. Return to the KJV and the Mormon interpretation thereof. He recommended I read J. Reuben Clark's book, Why the King James Version. I told him I had read it thoroughly, more than once. Had he read it, maybe we could discuss it? No. Regrettably, he had not. Nor could we discuss it. Ours was a divinely given task to instill testimonies, not waste time, in fruitless, endless discussion. I was at the time teaching early morning seminary in California, close to graduation, ready for a final review for entrance into the CES system. The review process took longer than planned. CES leaders came down from Utah to sit in my classes. I taught honestly. I respected my students' questions. I had my own. I didn't have all the answers. The decision was ultimately made. Many are called, but few are chosen. I spent some time searching the heavens. What was my mistake? What of my calling? Had I got it wrong? But there was a remembrance of a witness once received. I had to make a decision what to do with my life, to continue my studies or go back to the simple life of banging nails as a carpenter. I really did not have a choice. T.S. Eliot expressed the essence of my feelings, "We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started. And know the place for the first time." It was actually with anticipation that I launched into New Testament studies. But instead of the pastoral preachings of a loving God, I learned of the ambiguous teachings of Jesus, the healer, the exorcist, the quest for the historical Jesus, the problems of the resurrection narratives, the incredible infighting among the early apostles, the unfulfilled prophecies, Scripture that, if authored by God, was a divine deception, and that, if authored by man, was a valiant attempt to cover up. It was no illusion that with each course of study, God was inexorably pushed farther and farther from any relevance in my life. Truth was dissolving into relative perception. I could no longer trust that my perceptions of God, His will, and His church was truth with a capital T. But I was still a Mormon, and if I was cautious enough, ambiguous enough, selective enough, and as my wife urged, courteous enough, I could still find my place within that community I so loved. But my studies were not complete. Comparative religion classes were the death blow to my belief that Mormonism was the only true church, or even that Jesus was God's only begotten Son and my personal Savior. As I studied conversion and enlightened experiences of different religions, I saw my own teenage testimony within the light of open comparison and analysis. As a boy, I had immersed myself in Mormonism with an unqualified faith, an unqualified commitment, waiting for the moment of grace. It came as anticipated, as promised, and it witnessed the church to be true, just as the Catholic or Protestant is called, just as the Hindu is enlightened, just as the Muslim is guided. Through it all, I thought I was okay as far as the church was concerned, but somewhere along the path, I could no longer teach certain interpretations of Scripture as printed in the Elder's Quorum Manual. Somewhere along the path, I was released as Ola's Corman instructor, but yet allowed to teach the more advanced gospel doctrine class. I used the lesson manual less and less, mainly to read and comment directly from the scriptures. But somewhere along the path, I was removed from gospel doctrine to young adults, and from young adults to teacher's Corman advisor. Somewhere along the path, I was released entirely. Somewhere along the path, I stopped bearing a meaningless testimony. Every Sunday evening, I would gather with my extended family to hash out gospel subjects, unable to talk about any of this in the church. The family study group was my only forum. Just talking about it satisfied some need. But there were doubts and secrets I kept even from them. It wasn't worth the effort to pray. What did it mean to worship something called God? What place did God even play in my life or anyone else's life? I started seriously listening to my philosopher brother-in-law as he talked on the meaning of truth, of belief, of community values, and of the new Mormon history of Reconstruction. He, too, had lost so many of his central Mormon beliefs, but he seemed steadier than I was. He told me that my early absolute faith in Mormonism was probably the essence of my problem, that I had surrendered myself so totally to a divine authority that now I had no capacity to create my own values when I needed to. He reminded me of Sterling McMurrin's unique reply that he was never disillusioned with Mormonism because he was never illusioned in the first place. But I replied, I had received a witness. For a time, I found hope in the liberal theology developed mainly in the 19th century. I won't go into it for you. It wasn't what I had before. It wasn't filled with joy, but it was something. Then I embarked on a study of the problem of evil. I have no way of summarizing this journey. I have no time to elaborate. May I say, however, that when I hear the problem of evil treated less and with the searching solemnity which it demands, I am sickened. During the past year, I have rarely been to church. However, during a few weeks ago, I stood in the prayer circle to support the naming and the blessing of a new baby niece of mine. I experienced a wonderful feeling of community. I left after the blessing before they prepared the sacrament. I shake my head with wonder at the Protestant and Catholic theologians and even some Mormons who I know have lost what I have lost, yet still in their own private ways possess the will or the ability to worship. Sometimes I want to scream at them. What do you still find? What do you still have? What do you still experience that is worthy of worship? They offer spiritual reflections, contemplative moments, commitment to community, and their irrational faith in an unexplainable, imponderable deity. It leaves my soul unsatisfied. Last night, I heard a quote from David O. McKay that I want to paraphrase. Testimony, in order to be worthy of its name, must first pass through the crucible of doubt. I know I'm in that crucible. I see no way out.
Both my subject and my conclusions are included in my title, so you should memorize that, if nothing else. I am convinced, both in theory and from experience, that it is possible to find truth and to find God. Truth that matters, and a God who is personal, ravishing, and a trustworthy model. I believe the quest must start in hope, which I define as an active desire for this to be a meaningful and potent universe. Such hope includes an energetic yearning for a continuance of meaningful individual life after death and anxiousness to accept the responsibilities that such potential life implies. I know from experience that knowledge comes in abundance from such questing, but if the quest is honest, so does much skepticism. What faith is possible in this veil of tears on the other side of that is lies on the other side of that skepticism. and is made possible in part by our being energetic and persistent in that skepticism. In the passage from Alexander Pope that gives us the title for this session, you may remember that the line that rhymes with Pierian Spring talks about a little learning being a dangerous thing. So, as Chad has well demonstrated to us, is a little skepticism a dangerous thing. And finally, I believe that the faith possible is precious little for most of us who are intellectuals, which includes everyone in this room, that is, those who are blessed or cursed with the gift of knowledge. But it is precious above all that is sweet and precious, and it is sufficient for our needs. It is the main thing, I believe, we came to this earth to learn. It may seem strange that this essay, which is essentially upbeat and affirmative, I hope, should depend so much on such seemingly weak reeds as skepticism, and later on, the null hypothesis and the insufficiency of human satisfactions. But I hope you will come to agree with me that such weak things of human experience shall be found more reliable in important ways than objectivity, reason, the mighty and strong in the world's eyes. But let me first establish my perspective from two basic Mormon texts, both from the Book of Mormon. The first gives the most challenging and yet satisfying basis I've been able to find for ontology, that is, a concept of what the universe basically is. The second gives what I have found to be the most convincing and workable epistemology, that is, a concept of how we know anything. In 2 Nephi, chapter 2, Lehi teaches his son that it must needs be that there is an opposition in all things, and goes on to explain that this is not merely a descriptive statement about the divisions and conflicts of human personality and social interaction in history, but a proscriptive assertion about what the universe must be like, not only in order for righteousness and good to be brought to pass, but in order for life and sense and sensibility and the earth and God himself, even the universe itself, to exist. The crucial thing such opposition at the heart of things makes possible is the creative activity and choices of intelligence, initiated, at least in our sphere of present understanding, by God. Quote, "For if opposition is not, there is no God. And if there is no God, we are not, neither the earth, for there could have been no creation of things, neither to act nor to be acted upon, wherefore all things must have vanished away." This crucial ontological point is reinforced in a revelation that was given to Joseph Smith 3 years after the Book of Mormon was published. Quote, "All truth is independent in that sphere in which God has placed it to act for itself, as all intelligence also. Otherwise, there is no existence." But this scripture bridges ontology and epistemology, because it not only suggests that the very existence of the universe depends on the dynamism of opposition and the perplexing, joy-bringing, but also pain and sin-bringing creative play of intelligences, including God. The passage also states that truth, which we have been tempted to think of as static and permanently fixed, however hard to find, is also inseparably connected to that creative activity of intelligences and relative to the sphere of existence where it is pursued. As the Lord told Joseph Smith in that same revelation, truth is knowledge of things as they are, as they were, and as they are to be. And knowledge, as we have learned so well since the Romantic Revolution, changes as the knower changes. Truth may well be called the sum of existence, but by that very token, it is not eternal, unchanged evermore. The second text, Alma 32, gives us the best help, I believe, in both understanding how the knower knows and what the process of change is. It also helps us become motivated to get engaged in the process. Alma puts his finger on the essential dilemma of any epistemology. He points out that many in his time, just as in ours, start with a self-defeating prior condition before they will risk the search for truth in God. They say, "If thou wilt show unto us a sign from heaven, then we will know of a surety, then we will believe." Human beings claim they are perfectly willing to believe if only someone will provide perfect knowledge, clear, rational argument and evidence in advance. But Alma knows from experience that such is a snare and a delusion because, quote, "If a man knoweth a thing, he hath no cause to believe. He will be satisfied with those static, unprogressive, essentially trivial aspects of existence which are available for perfect knowledge, and he will not be motivated to change his life to conform to his knowledge. As Alma warns, how much more cursed is he that knoweth the will of God and doeth it not. Alma is interested in something much more important than the knowledge available empirically and rationally. That is, he is interested in faith, which he says is, quote, not to have a perfect knowledge of things. Wherefore, if ye have faith, ye hope for things which are not seen, which are true. In other words, we live in a universe not of our making, nor ultimately of God's, but just irrevocably there, in which the most important spiritual realities and meanings are not empirically available to mortals. Some of those realities, in fact, seem to be merely potentials yet to be created by those willing to hope and to proceed without perfect knowledge. Truth is to be found in the process of creating the true realities possible in our universe. God is to be discovered as the being who guides and nurtures that process, and the being we may become in that process. How then are we to proceed in such a strange universe, so unresponsive to our desire for a sign, for perfect clarity and assurance? Alma is extremely fair. He asks the bare minimum required for the process to begin. Awake and arouse your faculties, even to an experiment upon my words, and exercise a particle of faith. This is hope being described, because he goes on to explain, even if you can no more than desire to believe, let this desire work in you, even until you believe in a manner that you can give place for a portion of my words. At this point, alarm bells go off for all skeptics, especially those aware of cognitive dissonance, and the numerous ways mortals can delude themselves that Fetzinger and others have demonstrated so well. And those alarm bells should go off. Such are convinced that any tilt in the experiment, any emotional hang-up, any desire for social approval, any congenital or learned need, any desire to believe destroys complete disinterested neutrality, and thus the reliability of the experiment. And they are right about the destruction of neutrality, but not about the value and necessity of the experiment. Because all experiments unavoidably have at least those limitations, even the ones upon which the evidence of Fetzinger is based. No human endeavor at all, including science, would be possible without some desire, some chance-taking, some hope and vision, some assumptions, if no more than faith in the reliability of our senses to measure things. And there are some good safeguards against those minimal tilts, ones well proven in science and ones that Alma not only accepts but firmly insists upon. He is perfectly aware that the process he is describing, central to the life of the universe, is a fragile one, much like the growth of a plant, which is indeed the metaphor he chooses. The process can be aborted by tilts in either direction. On the one hand, the seed, even a true seed, a good seed, can be cast out by unbelief, by resisting the Spirit of the Lord. On the other hand, the seed can be bad, and, quote, if it groweth not, behold, it is not good. Therefore, it is cast away. It should be cast away. But clearly, Alma understands that some of us, because of cognitive dissonance or pride or fear or some other of the many ills that flesh is heir to, may go on harboring bad seeds, whether false doctrine, Mormon mythology, or simply incomplete notions that need to be improved or planted and nurtured. And we are not skeptical enough at this point if we delude ourselves that those bad seeds are growing. If we are not, we invalidate the experiment and do real damage to ourselves and others. But Alma realistically views even a successful experiment as only a beginning, though a crucial and rewarding step. Ye know that the word hath swelled your souls, and ye also know that it hath sprouted up, that your understanding doth begin to be enlightened, and your mind doth begin to expand. O then, is not this real? I say unto you, yea, because it is light. And whatsoever is light is good, because it is discernible. Therefore ye must know that it is good. And now, behold, after ye have tasted this light, is your knowledge perfect? Behold, I say unto you, nay. Neither must ye lay aside your faith, for ye have only exercised your faith to plant the seed, that ye might try the experiment to know if the seed was good. And now behold, if ye nourish it with much care, it will get root and grow up and bring forth fruit. This all strikes me as eminently reasonable and fair and modest. Yet it does not shrink from suggesting how difficult and risky the business of learning to know through faith really is. Though we may be blind and gullible pilgrims in a strange and deadly universe, assaulted on all sides by claims and counterclaims, there is an orderly way to begin to sort things out if we will only have the courage to hope, to desire a living and responsive universe, no matter how responsible that makes us, and the integrity to genuinely test the seed, and the grit to nurture the plant, whatever increasing demands that places on us. If we refuse to begin or continue the process, the judgment lies not on the universe, despite Albert Camus' pained and painful arguments, but upon ourselves. If ye neglect the tree and take no thought for its nourishment, behold, it will not get any root. And when the seed of the sun, or of a sunstone symposium, cometh and scorcheth it, because it hath no root, it withers away. And ye pluck it up and cast it out. Now this is not because the seed was not good, neither is it because the fruit thereof would not be desirable, but it is because your ground is barren. And thus, if ye will not nourish the seed, looking forward with an eye of faith to the fruit thereof, ye can never pluck of the fruit of the tree of life. On the other hand, Alma's promise, which I have tested many times and found as true as anything I know, is that, quote, because of your diligence and your faith and your patience with the word in nourishing it, that it may take root in you, behold, by and by ye shall pluck the fruit thereof, which is most precious, which is sweet above all that is sweet, and which is white above all that is white, yea, and pure above all that is pure, and ye shall feast upon this fruit even until ye are filled, that ye hunger not, neither shall ye thirst. No wonder that fruit was so desirable to Adam and Eve. I mean that very seriously, because I believe that was precisely the fruit they learned to partake of in the garden, through great effort and moral anguish and courage. Their courageous choice to partake of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil began for us all the opportunity to engage in a similar process of growth, one not available in any other way, and one, therefore, that our Heavenly Father and Mother, in great sorrow, but in great hope, had to send us forth to do, on our own, though with Christ's necessary and sufficient help. I know I haven't pinned down precisely the only true way of finding God and truth, but it is one way, I believe, one that I, as your fellow pilgrim in this lone and dreary world, can bear witness to. I really know of no better way to describe it than Alma's, because he not only persuasively argues for its viability, but his words convey, with the power of great literature, compelling evidence of his conviction and of the desirability of the way. What I can do at this point is merely relate some contemporary ideas and experiences that might increase our understanding and willingness to try that way to the fruit of knowledge. For instance, many modern scientists and philosophers have carefully removed any basis for undue pride in, or even much confidence about, the once touted powers of critical intelligence and the certainties of science. This news, I realized, hasn't reached everyone attending or even speaking at these symposia, as witness the embarrassingly naive, logical positivist dismissal of the Book of Mormon that got by the review board and was delivered with a great deal of hubris to last year. Just as examples of what is available to a general audience, to all of us, see Lewis Thomas's essay on the uncertainty of science in the September-October 1980 Harvard Magazine, which argues powerfully for humble attention to our still very mysterious but essential human gifts for ambiguity and for language. Quote, the culmination of a liberal arts education ought to include, among other matters, the news that we do not understand a flea, much less the making of a thought. Alston Chase, philosopher and writer, in a forum address at BYU, recently presented the evidence for what we have lost since the Renaissance by exalting knowledge over virtue and faith, not only in public and private evil committed by perfectly intelligent beings like the Nazis, whose power to do evil was increased by science, but not their will to avoid it, but also in educational disarray and general anxiety. Quote, the academic community, by putting scholarly ideals above spiritual and moral ones, has forgotten how to make value judgments and therefore does not know how to say what ought to be taught. Nuclear bombs, genetic experimentations, industrial pollution, carcinogens in processed foods are all products of our own ingenuity and unlimited desire. In the end, our fears remain because we have chosen neither to limit knowledge nor to rein in the human will. Instead, we have decided to follow our curiosity wherever it will lead, even though this random wandering of the intellect leaves our fate to chance. In all of history, this unleashing of reason and ego is unprecedented. Only in my lifetime have educators abandoned all pretense to limit reason by faith. End of quote. But you may well be saying, haven't you just been praising desire and knowledge as parts of the process of finding truth? Yes, certainly, but only in the context of Alma's thorough and balanced treatment of the process of gaining faith. The process begins in quote, a hope for things which are not seen, which are true. But where do we get any idea about what Paul called, in a similar definition of faith, the substance of things hoped for, so that we can go on to develop through Alma's process, quote, evidence for things not seen? Joseph Smith, in the lectures on faith, taught that three things are necessary for viable faith, that is, faith unto salvation: the idea that God exists, a correct knowledge of his attributes, and confidence that we are living in harmony with those attributes of integrity, charity, humility, etc. The first two conditions are provided in history and revelation. God has assured us that he will not leave us comfortless, and throughout the scriptures he both gives us the evidence and reminds us how important that evidence is for what Moroni calls in the preface to the Book of Mormon, what great things God has done for our fathers. But though God makes available the essential knowledge on which hope and proper desire can be based to us all through his loving watchfulness over human history, we must finally reach out to Christ for the power to repent and put our lives sufficiently in harmony with the divine nature, which we have accepted or hope for, that our hope can be properly directed and our knowledge sufficiently humble. Then, if our skepticism is adequately persistent, we can begin to develop a growing and saving faith, I believe. I remember with continuing pain a conversation of nearly 30 years ago with a friend, a fine young poet and thoughtful, sensitive husband and father. He and his wife had decided to no longer be involved with Mormonism, not because it wasn't true, but because they were afraid it was. He had considered carefully the pervading Mormon rhetoric about the celestial kingdom, apparently a place of organizational charts, high-powered administration, constant progress measured by graphs, assignments and evaluation, and constant cheer of the kind best imaged as a perennial missionary zone conference or a Shackley Salesforce meeting. He had accepted the image as accurate. He had accepted the image as accurate and decided that he wanted no part of such a heaven because there would obviously be no place for poets. Like Huckleberry Finn, he said, "All right, I'll go to hell," because his sound heart would not accept the values of the society that had conditioned him. But my friend was wrong. His desire was not Christ-centered enough and his skepticism not persistent enough to help him beyond his knowledge that was flawed and limited, to help him move to a growing and life-giving faith in the living God of his own best imaginings, who I believe is a poet. Since time is limited, let me end with a few somewhat miscellaneous ideas about the process I have advocated and hope they will help provoke discussion from which we all can learn. The other weak reeds I mentioned at first were the null hypothesis and, quote, the insufficiency of human satisfactions. The first refers to a process familiar from algebra and best used in Mormon thought, I think, by Hugh Nibley, by which the apparently negative, even corrosive power of skeptical logic can be turned to the service of affirming propositions rather than constant attack on them. For example, rather than merely pointing to logical and evidential weaknesses or problems in the claim that the Book of Mormon is of divine origin, a very easy thing to do, or trying to prove the claim directly, an impossible thing to do, we can make the null or negative hypothesis that the book is not divine, was written by Joseph Smith or some other early 19th century person, and then apply all of our skeptical logical tools scrupulously to that, with the result, I believe, a powerful argument that the null hypothesis is not true, and by logical implication, the reverse is true. The Book of Mormon is divine. In general, if we would be as rigorously honest and thorough in questioning our negative conclusions as we are our positive, we would find God and truth more easily. Skepticism should keep us from accepting inadequate answers and hope, false hope, but also from accepting inadequate refutations and self-indulgent despair. To risk all for it, gamble everything, certainly time and intellectual persistence, and working out our salvation in fear and trembling, rather than getting lost in absurdly fair or, quote, objective game of letting all the negative evidence overbalance the little but sufficient positive evidence. If I am marooned on a desert island, and our life here is much like that, absolutely dependent on finding another human being to comfort and perhaps save me, the one little swale where I find a single footprint is more important, more true, than the other hundreds of square miles where I find nothing. I'll skip over the insufficiency of human satisfactions. That's maybe a red herring. Finally, I believe that the struggle to find truth is only really successful when united with the struggle to find God, that it is worth the pain and setbacks, and that it is worth enduring to the end. I believe the evidences God has provided in history and in the Scriptures are adequate to show what great things He has done for our fathers and can do for us if we will persist in the hope that such evidence provides. I believe His grace is sufficient, that He will visit us with assurance and spiritual confirmation from time to time, not as we demand it, but as He knows we need it. And I believe the Church of Jesus Christ is the best context on earth in which to carry on the struggle, because it provides ways to know and serve Christ that can direct and discipline our desires, and thus make our hope genuinely in things that are real and true but not seen. And it can teach us, through the sacrificial service it requires, and unconditional love it thus helps us learn, to persist in humility, to not be consumers of truth, but servants of truth, and to affirm the struggle, becoming as little children, willing as Joseph Smith the boy was, to ask and let it be given, to knock and let the door open. In a recent interview, Sterling McMurrin, one of the brightest people I know, and truly a post-Enlightenment rationalist, bore his testimony as follows. I came to the conclusion at a very early age, earlier than I can remember, that you don't get books from angels and translate them by miracles. I find that a remarkably unskeptical assertion, one that manifests much greater faith than I am capable of. Faith, that is, in a dogmatic and quite limited view of the world. I am inclined to believe that what Shakespeare has Hamlet remind us, that there are stranger things than are dreamed of in any of our philosophies. Joseph Smith was more skeptical than Sterling McMurrin, more willing to question the most basic things and thus to make contact with the most basic divine realities and learn basic truths about the universe. As we learn more about Joseph as a practitioner of folk magic, one still in tune with forces and perceptions that had not yet been destroyed by Enlightenment rationalism, and thus able later to look back to what he called the ancient pattern of things, I hope we will not let our rationalist limitations shock and disappoint us too much. We may even open up a bit ourselves. After all, it seems to me much easier to believe that the living God of the Scriptures, the one whom I desire to love and serve and know, could make himself known to a boy still capable of seeking treasures in the earth than to someone who is certain you just don't get books from angels.
Since I've been threatened with serious bodily harm by Chad if I go over my time, I am going to have to set a little, well, if I can do it.
Well, would you please tell me when I have 5 minutes?
Oh, okay. And the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked. A friend of mine once told me, just as I was beginning my studies at Catholic University, Tony, when you study religion in graduate school, it's like suddenly deciding to learn everything you can about a dear and rare plant that you've had in your garden for years. I'm a gardener, and this was very meaningful for me. You finish up by pulling it up by the roots, dissecting it, having gotten all the knowledge possible out of it, and then trying to plant it back into the ground so that it can continue to grow now that you understand it. But then you'll find out that it's dead. And although you understand the plant, it doesn't matter anymore, for you've lost something dear to you. In preparing to speak on the subject of the effect of study on my faith, I thought of several images that I've come across in recent reading. They describe the confrontation of traditional faith with modernity. That's not maternity, that's modernity, like modernity, right? Modernity. Now, modernity is those secular approaches to understanding and meaning which in large part lie behind the intellectual and technological world in which the majority of Western cultures and ever increasingly Eastern and African cultures are now blessed, or if you will, cursed. One image. Chaim Potok, in his book The Promise, draws a touching scene of a conversation between a father and a son who are both Orthodox Jews committed to a modern critical understanding of the Talmud and are somewhat put off by the narrow-mindedness and bigotry of Hasidic and ultra-Orthodox defenders of traditional Jewish faith. They attend the Hasidic wedding of the son's best friend, a wedding full of the joyous songs and exulting dances to God characteristic of Hasidism. Afterwards, on their way home, they discuss in wonder these Hasids and their particular group leader, their Rebbe. "He is a remarkable man," my father murmured. "They are a remarkable people." "I wish they weren't so afraid of new ideas." "You want a great deal, Ravain. The Messiah has not yet come. Will new ideas enable them to go on singing and dancing?" "We can't ignore the truth, Abba." "No," he said, "we cannot ignore the truth. At the same time, we cannot sing and dance as they do." He was silent a moment. "That is the dilemma of our time, Ravain. I do not know what the answer is." Another image. The description given by an elderly native Israeli woman of the first secular Jews that she had ever met in her youth. They had come to her village as socialist experimenters and Zionists and taught in the local Jewish school. "They opened up the doors of the world for us, but they closed up the heavens forever." Paul Tillich talks of calls this process having one's myths broken, and notes that once broken, a myth is like Humpty Dumpty, never to be put back together again. Thomas Kuhn's idea of a paradigm shift has also been used to describe the process of religious accommodation to modernity. Peter Berger, in The Heretical Imperative, identifies three possible reactions to modernity. One, a reduction of faith, where one throws away the beliefs that one had and lapses into various kinds of nihilism. Two, a deduction of faith, where one continues, either in a fundamentalist or neo-Orthodox mode, to believe what one held before the confrontation. Evidence to the contrary be damned. And three, this is what I'm mainly interested in, an induction of faith, where one recognizes the strengths and joys of belief, but reserves judgment concerning the specific content of faith, pending further inductive study and experience. The content of faith is put into an open-ended, and that's, I have to stress that word, an open-ended dialectic with experience and evidence. Bernard Lonergan, in his Method in Theology, describes the process of confrontation with modernity as a differentiation of consciousness, a growing complexity of mental processes and the web of meaning, as well as a rejection of the simplicity and the harmony that existed before you had the confrontation. He says that those who have not experienced this differentiation cannot have any idea what it is and have difficulty even conceiving that any such thing is possible. Some of you here might feel that about what I'm talking about. What is he talking about? What's the problem? What's Chad's problem, for heaven's sake? You know, geez, he lost his faith. Those having suffered the pain of transition know that they can never return from whence they came, and yet understand all too well the mentality of those who are not yet differentiated, for they themselves remember having had that innocence. Images used by differentiated consciousnesses are many. Liberation from bondage, escaping parochial ignorance, leaving the ghetto, and finally facing up to the truth. Fawn McKay Brody called it shedding a winter coat and garments in the middle of summer. There is a great gulf fixed between those of differentiated consciousness and those still in the bliss of undifferentiation. There are images for this chasm as well. This concept finds beautiful narrative expression in Marion Zimmer Bradley's Wiccan retelling of the Arthurian cycle, The Mists of Avalon. Told from the perspective of Morgan Le Fay, Arthur's witch half-sister and mother of his son and usurper Mordred, the book notes that, quote, "It is the belief of mankind which shapes the world and all reality," end of quote. Avalon, the Isle of the Blessed in the novel's Wiccan religion, that's, you know, the worship of the mother goddess. I'm not saying wicked, it's Wiccan religion. Avalon, the Isle of the Blessed in the novel's Wiccan religion, is seen to occupy the same space, though different topography and sequence of time, as the Christian Isle of the Isle of the Priests, the historical Itris Witrin, the same island, yet profoundly different islands, seen with the eyes of two separate faith systems. The two islands and their inhabitants are separated by the beliefs of their inhabitants, represented in the novel by the magically thick fogs and mists surrounding Avalon, frightening and painful to penetrate. A different concept lies behind John Boorman's recent film, The Emerald Forest, which contrasts technological secular culture and a fictitious Amazonian Stone Age tribal culture, which views our world as the dead land beyond the edge of the world, understand developed real estate, ever encroaching upon the rainforest, inhabited by the sickly, pale termite people, understand white men who cut down the trees. Both images, the mists of Avalon and the frightening edge of the world, speak to the pain of ideological transition and the great difficulty in communication that exists between believers, the believers of differing worldviews. Christer Stendahl has noted that in the next quarter century, the greatest challenge to Christian ecumenism will not be the differences between denominations, but rather the chasm running through all denominations between those who have begun to come seriously to grips with modernity and those who have not. Often, differentiated types find themselves much further away from their co-religionists who have not made the shift than from each other, even across denominational boundaries. Fundamentalists have their own images to describe the confrontation with modernity. For them, accepting modernity is a Faustian bargain in which we trade away our own souls, peace of mind, and hope in exchange for knowledge, a control over nature, and an understanding of such things as history, texts, and, in the case of psychology, even the human soul, which has been lost in the bargain. Secular modernity, in and of itself, in this worldview, is seen as a threat and an evil. Accommodations made to the world are, if not a bargain with the devil and a covenant with death, at the very least, foolish errors that border on the sinful. Bruce R. McConkie and Joseph Fielding Smith called it accepting the philosophies of men instead of the revealed truths of God. This view, of course, does not take into account the fact that all human thought is bound up in greater or lesser degrees in philosophical systems. Indeed, it ignores all of the evidence suggesting that even revelation is bounded by the constraints of any other human knowledge. But such images as that are not manufactured out of whole cloth. They in part stem from the fact that there appears to be a pattern of greater devotion and piety, indeed morality, among the undifferentiated. In Pottock's view, they seem to be able to dance and sing better. Okay? As Jonathan Swift put it humorously, what good is the freedom of thought in matters religious if it is not joined with the freedom to, quote, drink and whore on and defy the parson, end of quote. Those who refuse modernity not only seem to be happier, but they seem to live more praiseworthy lives. I have often noted in my own wards that some of the most strident fundamentalists, as well as the most innocently naive, seem to be the best examples for me of Christian living and compassionate service. Conversely, very often when a person confronts modernity, there seems to be a concomitant breakdown in their morals. To be sure, this perception is fostered by time-honored LDS traditions, believing that sign-seeking is an outward symptom of adultery, and that's real-life adultery, not metaphorical adultery, as well as the habit that we have of blackening the character of anyone who disagrees with us theologically. However, this view misunderstands the interrelation of modernity and sin. Generally, true believers come to change their ideologies before they change their actions. And thus, modernity itself is not the result of and mere self-justification for personal sin. On the contrary, sinners come in all ideologies. And despite the immediate deleterious effect of the painful transition upon morals and devotion, personal ideological accommodation to modernity actually affords enhanced opportunity for spiritual and moral development. Despite appearances, a good deed performed by a person who no longer simply assumes a just God's reward or punishment entails more moral merit than the same act performed by a person expecting the deed to be duly recorded by angels in heaven who are silent notes keeping. I think that this is so if only because the former psychologically requires more sacrifice and is done for its own sake. There's another image that's recently been brought up in the discussion, and that is, and Gene referred to it briefly, and that's the idea that when we make accommodations, like with the new Mormon history, what that actually is Mormons who have lost their faith opting for a worldview that's foreign. And they don't, and they're taking evidence seen in that worldview. It's the problem of the differing worldviews. I mean, they live in totally different worlds. And the new Mormon historians supposedly take evidence, which is only evidence if you believe that worldview. If you don't believe that worldview, who cares? You know, who cares about this Martin Harris letter or whatever, you know? Who cares? We know what's true. The difficulty with that is that in a pluralistic society such as exists in the ever-shrinking modern world, real people of different worlds rub real shoulders with each other. And out of such rubbing, there seems to be kindled a social construction that transcends individual cultural traditions, as well as the various subjectivities in which all human beings necessarily experience whatever it is out there that we seem to be experiencing. An accident at Three Mile Island can give cancer to the Lancaster County, Pennsylvania Amish, as well as to those whose homes are lit and warmed by the plant's electricity. Regardless of their beliefs, members of the Flat Earth Society see the same newspaper pictures of the Earth taken from spacecraft as do the general population that happens to accept the cosmological theories upon which the spacecraft's navigation is based. Similarly, survivors of a nuclear holocaust, if there are any, will have to deal with the same problem of survival as they crawl out from under the rubble, whether they believe the flash to be the fire of the second coming or not. In short, within the larger social construction, there are such things as data. It's not something merely thought up of. And I'm not trying to defend positivism here. I'm not a positivist. But there is a larger social construction that we're faced with, and that's the fact. And you're dishonest if you refuse to face it. And that's the problem. I mean, we didn't get ourselves into this situation, but we're here. And the question is how we respond to it. To bring home this point to this audience, let me put the problem this way. Believers in ancient Nephites and Lamanites, believers in a historical Adam or Eve, believers in a worldwide flood, believers in a Joseph Smith clean of any taint of money digging, necromancy, or lying to his wife, believers in the prima facie trustworthiness of official LDS pronouncements concerning Brigham Young's doctrine of God, or the official sanctioning of polygamy after the manifesto, believers in a temple ceremony that comes from the ancient world and has nothing to do with 19th century masonry, disbelievers in Darwinian theorizing, and disbelievers in secular biblical criticism and LDS history in general, all of these, sooner or later, run into some evidence that their views are not part of the general consensus of society. If they look into the matter more closely, they generally soon realize that in terms of near universally accepted canons of evidence and reasoning, there is much to recommend the general consensus on these views and little to recommend, honestly, the minority opinions they hold. How one reacts to that dilemma tells much about how secure one is in one's personal experience of God, how much value a person puts on the changing doctrinal formulations such as have existed in the Christian Mormon communities, and how rigorously honest a person is willing to be with oneself concerning the evidence provided by experience and observation of all kinds, both scholarly and spiritual. Despite the subjectivities that none of us can accept, that none of us can escape, and the divergences between the worldviews of differing social constructions, there is indeed something out there that somehow relates to the worlds we experience. Avalon's mists, while separating the worlds experienced by differently believing people, are not part of the real weather contained in these worlds, weather affecting the crops, food, and livelihood of people regardless of their belief system. As the Lord wisely put it, our Father in heaven makes his sun to rise on the evil and the good and sends rain on the just and the unjust. This is not to say that beliefs are not important or are not real. Beliefs matter more than anything else in this life when we seek ultimate meaning and value and the ability to live productive and upright lives. Beliefs allow some of us to sing and dance, to act morally or feel hope. Different beliefs allow others of us to control the physical environment or give detailed and meaningful accounting of the origins and development of human thought, even human thought imputed to be revealed by God. It is precisely because beliefs are so important that individually we are able to make the pilgrimage from one world of belief into the other, only at great personal price. For what allows the advantages of one world is oftentimes in conflict with the preconditions of the other. It's not done. Is it time? Oh, 5 more. Okay, 5 minutes more. Yes. Is there any way out of the dilemma? 5 minutes more, right? Okay. Is there any way out of the dilemma? Can we have the differentiation of modernity on the one hand and faith? Can we have our cake and eat it too? I believe that differentiation does not necessarily entail a rejection of all religious faith and an adoption of nihilism. Jay Kellenberger has recently shown the purely logical reasons for this in his article, The Slippery Slope of Religious Relativism in Religious Studies, just this last year. For me, however, there are compelling existential reasons for this as well. They are rooted in our very conception of what understanding is. Before the beginning of modern secularity, understanding was seen as an act of empathy between knower and object known. St. Thomas Aquinas, for instance, identifies the act of understanding as one of connaturality. Those of you who know French, you know the verb connaître as opposed to savoir, for the verb to know. It's an act of connaturality, or mutual recognition of things having common origins in their creation. For Francis Bacon, however, generally recognized as the founder of the modern scientific method, understanding was an act of power, an act where the knower came to be able to control or make use of, either practically or theoretically, the object known. He writes in his New Organon, "Truth and utility are here the very same things. For of all signs, there is none more certain or more noble than that taken from fruits. For fruits and works are, as it were, sponsors and sureties for the truth of philosophies." For better or for worse, this functional view of truth and understanding is part of the atmosphere we breathe and cannot be easily gotten rid of. But the problem here is, with this view of truth or understanding, is that it overlooks the ancient view of wisdom. In the words of the psalmist, "The fear of Yahweh is the beginning of wisdom." The sense of control and pragmatic utility at the root of our modern idea of understanding is at odds with the essential element of any religious perspective, that is, the yearning for God, the recognition of one's own powerlessness and lack of control, and the need for a power higher, better, and greater than oneself. In short, the fear of Yahweh. It is this contradiction, I believe, that lies at the root of modernity's uncanny ability to ungod us even against our will. We gain control over a subject in religious studies, for instance, by objectifying it and killing it. We gain control, and this appeals to our personal pride at our own cleverness. A sense of control and a sense of pride crowd out of our hearts any room for God, and a Faustian bargain has indeed been struck. And though we might continue nominally repeating the affirmations of our faith tradition, we are no longer faithful men and women. The worst part of this bargain with the devil is that we are cheated. We might have some technical control granted, but that control is never absolute, and oftentimes the results are far worse than no control at all. A case in point is our current nuclear technologies and the arms race that they have spawned. On the other hand, it is possible to remain religious and faithful even though the formulations of tradition cease to have any meaning to us in the light of modernity. The first commandment is not, "Thou shalt grant intellectual assent to the proposition that God exists." Rather, the commandment is, "Thou shalt love." "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, might, mind, and strength." Love, the yearning, the caring, the serving, is the command, not mere intellectual assent. The Book of Mormon phrases the idea differently by saying that in the planting of the seed of faith, it is not so important that one believe, but only that one have a desire to believe. Another of Scripture in the Book of Mormon that addresses yearning and faith, learning and faith, one often abused by detractors of intellectual pursuit, is, to be learned is good if they hearken to the counsels of God. As normally used, this reads, it's okay to be a smarty pants as long as you do what you're told. Or if you want to put it in more succinct aphoristic terms, the mantle is greater than the intellect. But this reading of this verse misunderstands the passage. The term hearkened to, though associated in the Book of Mormon with the idea of obedience, is not its semantic equivalent. Rather, hearkened to means to pay attention to listen carefully to be deeply concerned with. Thus, the basic idea of the verse in the Book of Mormon is to gain knowledge and understanding is good if you do not ultimately lose your sense of dependence and powerlessness and your desires to learn God's will and follow it. Lehi's dream is another example of that. Those people going through those mists of darkness hand over hand, it says they can't reach that tree of life if they don't very carefully keep on going hand over hand. That's not because the problem is solved. The mists haven't gone away. They're probably wondering the whole time. They can't see what they're holding. The mists are too dark. They're probably wondering the whole time what in the world it is that they're holding on their hands, and they hope that it's there. Okay? My final word on the whole subject is from the book of Genesis. And I think that the book of Genesis gives us the whole key to it. It's in the myth of the defection of man and woman, every man and woman, from Yahweh and their subsequent being cast out of paradise. We start out in the bliss of our undifferentiation, happy, able to sing, because we are unaware of our nakedness. In the Old Testament, nakedness is a steady symbol for helplessness, poverty, and humiliation or degradation. Quite simply put, the man and woman, all of us, are powerless, but they are unaware of it because they are God-wrapped, certain of their promises and obligations. Yet we are beckoned to by the external world in which we all live, regardless of our ideologies. Note that the man and woman are tried not by a demon or a devil in the book of Genesis, but by one of Yahweh's creatures, Genesis 3:1. Now the snake was the craftiest of all the creatures Yahweh had made. It's the external world. It's what Yahweh created that tempts them. A desire to understand, to be like God, knowing good and evil, works on us, and we do eat of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. We suddenly lose our hope, our joy, and we see the meaninglessness of our existence. We see our nakedness because we have partaken. At this point, we try to cover our helplessness and our pitiableness with fig leaf loincloths. We try all sorts of techniques of self-delusion to try to recreate for ourselves the feelings that we had before. We lie to ourselves. We blame others for our predicament, and perhaps even lie to others about the knowledge that got us into this situation. For you see, we fail to recognize that we were naked all along, that our former sense of being God-wrapped was itself a misperception. Some cover themselves with large and elaborately wrought fundamentalist fig-leaf loincloths. Others, more parsimoniously, only cover what they consider to be the bare essentials, considering themselves liberal and comfortable with their nudity, within limits, of course. Some of these finally give up on the enterprise altogether. They throw their loincloths off and resign themselves to meaninglessness and nihilism, and declare often in very self-satisfied tones that at least now they are honest, though without hope. Or they say that hope must be made by fully independent men and women, creating it out of their own resources in the midst of this existence of nothingness. At this point, the question of honesty and personal pride becomes crucial. If one truly recognizes one's nakedness, one's powerlessness, one's hopelessness, and inability to manage or find meaning in life or live a moral life, And if in one's heart of heart one really hopes and wishes to believe, or at least have a desire to believe, in the words of W.P. Montague, that the things that matter most are not at the mercy of the things that matter least, then we can surrender to a power greater than ourselves. We can surrender to God, even though we don't know what in the hell God is. At this point, God discovers us hiding from him and asks us painful questions about how we have gotten into our position, and he finally sends us consciously out of the paradise that we have been trying to pretend we still inhabit. But as we leave, God has pity on us, these pitiable creatures of his, And he himself sews for us beautiful leather clothing to cover our nakedness so that we might not rely on our own ridiculous fig leaves. Note that in the myth it is Yahweh himself who makes the clothing and not the man and the woman. It is only by trusting ourselves wholly in God, even in ignorance, even in unawareness, even in mists of darkness, and in God's ability to give us hope, meaning, and the power to live moral lives, that we can be saved from the hell that our knowledge has gotten us into. By surrendering our souls and admitting the limits of our knowledge, we can keep our knowledge and the limited power it grants us, as well as our souls themselves. The doors to the world can remain open to us, but at the same time, the heavens can remain open too. We can afford not to ignore the truth, because God will give us the hope to dance.
For myself personally, and I hope for all of us collectively, I want to thank our three panelists. I hope that we won't leave the room today with some kind of hope or faith that these positions are reconcilable or can be reduced to some kind of harmonious position. As a critical yet dialectical Mormon Marxist, I'm committed that we need to wrestle with all three positions. My freshman year of religious studies at California State University was Chad Francisco's last, and it was he and a relatively undiscovered at this point Mormon scholar by the name of Dan Bogle that opened up for me the horizons of critical scholarship. It's Tony Hutchinson who now guides me as I look for new paradigms and methods for theological construction. And throughout it all, I've been nourished in ways that I can tell no one by Brother England. Well, now's the time for questions. I hope that you'll raise them. I think that the room is large enough that it might be advantageous to stand as you ask your question, and please try to address them in such a way that all of us will be able to hear. Let's start right over here.
I'll respond. I mean, you know, Chad would respond to me by saying, yeah, but you and Gene are just, you know, schmucking it up, because when push comes to shove, at the bottom, you don't believe, but you want to believe, and so you're going to pull a job on yourself to believe. Okay, I mean, that's what he's going to say. And, all right, if you don't want to believe, Chad, feel free to you know, I mean, that's the situation that you're in. That's the problem. For me, the issue really is the question of whether you're willing to just recognize your situation and be brutally honest with it. For me, you see, there's a big difference between me and a lot of the intellectuals of the earlier. It isn't qualitatively better? Oh, you're dwelling in a different world, and the only difference is if you're dwelling in the rainforest singing to frogs to control the weather, well, that's all very fine and good, but it doesn't necessarily function well. Well, I hope still is.
Can I suggest that we possibly move on to another question at this point, here on the front?
I really don't know what I do till I talk to him, because I don't think it's possible to anticipate what would be best in that situation. It might be best to help him leave his Mennonite faith if it had been shattered and find a new faith. I think the paradigm would work in either case, whether I were to try to help him recover or rebuild with new insight and get rid of the bad seeds, which every faith includes, or to completely restructure with new seeds. I think the process would work in either case. I really do. But I would have to deal with him personally as I talked with him and found him responding and felt directly his emotion, his need, his doubts, shared with him my own. So it would be very hard to answer in general, except I guess I do really believe in the paradigm for anyone. I've seen it used by people in other faiths without knowing its particular process. I think it's very close to what some of the modern epistemologists like Hayek and Popper and others that I respect are describing in rather secular terms. It includes the kind of humility that they advocate, the need for us to get beyond our, I think, irrational elitist faith in the paradigms of Plato and Hegel and Aquinas and Marx and others, and get back to a very fundamental one that each of us can rely on personally with humility rather than authority figures of any kind. So it's a process I do believe in, beyond my own experience with Mormonism. But it certainly seems to me deeply verified by Alma and his obviously personal experience with it. I don't know if that answers your question.
Sure.
Well, let me try to say something about that. I think our greatest dilemma as Latter-day Saints, which I experience daily, is to feel part of a universal human family together in a veil of tears where we're all in exactly the same situation, and yet to feel that we have been given a gift that is valuable for us and valuable to share with other people. That sounds contradictory. I don't think it has to be. I think there are a lot of problems that that poses for us as we relate to ourselves, to others, and to the world. That was... I'm tempted to say that's an evidence of where the only light remaining in this room is, but I've been advocating humility, so I won't do that. I feel that very painfully. I confess the greatest challenge to my faith, my most fundamental faith, is no longer the problem of evil, but I feel that, I think, nearly as deeply as Chad does, and my heart goes out to him as I sense his pain. But I've come to the point that I see that pain itself as an evidence for the existence of God. I really do believe that the human capacity to always be looking beyond what can satisfy us now is itself part of our divinity. And I think I can make some good arguments for that. But the thing I do find very difficult to deal with intellectually and personally is God's efficiency. Because as I look at human history or look at my neighborhood or look at the world, it's very hard to understand a God who has somehow been involved in the world and yet in which we find a world where if it's so important to know Christ, and especially if it's so important to know him the way we as Latter-day Saints do, why is it so very, very few have ever even had the chance to? And my only answer to that, and it's not a complete or fully satisfying answer, but one that helps me deal with it, is that there is something going on in every precious human life that is terribly important and the most important thing in this life, and I think it is the process of learning to live by faith, to live when we are not constantly guided by God. I think we cannot continue to exist in this universe wholly dependent on him as we were in the spirit world, that he sent us here to begin the process of learning to be independent. And it is a terribly painful process, but one that I think we need to realize every human being is engaged in. As Joseph Smith said, every intelligence that comes into this life is capable of increase and growth. If we would look at every other intelligence in this world, including ourselves, with that kind of respect, and then realize that if that is true, and if a loving God is doing everything he can to help every human intelligence increase, then we better get off our parochialism about Mormonism or even about Christianity, because there's a lot going on out there that has nothing to do with either, and it must be terribly valuable. But I think it finally gets back to the process I've described, that that is a process available to every human being, that they can learn to live by faith.
I'm not sure if this is God or someone in the back trying to give us a message with the light. I think this might be a good point to break off. The speakers and panelists will be up here if you want to ask further personal questions. Thank you.